So this Pachubandha Dhamma, here and now, this relentless reminding oneself, enlightenment is now, liberation is now. So this is a reflection, it's not a command or an imperative, it's a reminder. And then, of course, you know, if you say that, if you say liberation is now, enlightenment is now, then maybe the self will come into it, thinking, what does that mean? Am I enlightened now? Or because on a condition level, of course, we see ourselves from the personality view, the thinking mind, as this individual body, this person. But I found it very helpful in my own practice to always bring that reminder into the present, enlightenment here and now, liberation now. And then to observe how the personality or the emotional habits arise. Who gets enlightened? What is it that's enlightened here and now? I don't feel enlightened. This morning I'm just sleepy and woke up in a grumpy mood and I don't feel that I can, there's any enlightenment in me at this moment, blah, blah, blah. Or whatever. Or just doubt, or what is he talking about? So I'm not saying that I'm enlightened as a person here and now. You know, it's not like me as Ajahn Sumedho or a person or an individual claiming that I'm enlightened. It's reflective remembering. Recognition. And so like in the Akalika Dhamma, timelessness. Timelessness is now. And so you have this, keep reminding yourself that tomorrow the future is the unknown, the past is a memory. And then keep remembering that there's only the now, you know, and experience is now. You can imagine having a happy future, but that wish or hope or desire for a happy future is now. So you're remembering the past, it's the memories arise here and now, wherever you are. In the temple, in your kuti, on an airplane in London or wherever, it doesn't matter. The time is now, the place is here. So that's why I encourage you to really observe this sense of yourself as I'm this person with these problems, I need to practice meditation, get my samadhi so that I can become enlightened before I die or sometime in the future. So this is a thought, this is a perception, it is what it is, you know, not saying it's right or wrong. But with the Vipassana meditation, you're observing things as they are, not as they seem to be. So on a personal level, you know, it's about seeming and how I feel, how the mood, the here and now affects me personally. Am I happy, sad, elated, depressed, bored, confused? Or how do you see yourself as a person, you know? And feel about yourself as a person, as an individual. And of course, these are, you know, if we don't have this perspective, then of course we're always operating from this sense of, I've got to get something I don't have yet. And what I have now, or, you know, I see faults and weaknesses. I have anger and greed and fears. I've got to get rid of these. And I've got to really work on myself, improve myself. And so this Pachupanatama, here and now, now using this, when I think this, when I reflect on this, just using this word, Pachupanatama, or Puto, then it's a condition in itself, but it's not an attachment, it's merely a skillful means. The priority is here and now, not about you attaining and becoming, or however you conceive yourself as capable, incapable, good meditator, not very good. But this continuous reminding, sati sampajanya. So like the temple here is how to use this temple for that reminding, the Buddha Rupa, or the Bodhinyana Hall, or the sala, or the Ubon room, or your own kuti, or the retreat center. You know, the place is, this place is filled with Buddha images everywhere. In the garden. And so these are, you know, these can be just seen aesthetically or just ignored or whatever, but actually using these Buddha images as a reminder, here and now, Pachupanatama Puto. And then that sense of the gap where the mind, the thinking mind packs up for a while, stops, nonplussed, shocked. There's a sense of awe, isn't it, when you have this, when you look up at the stars at night, or the full moon, or and look at a Grand Canyon, or a beautiful scene, or something where this, you feel this sense of awe. What is awe? It's where your thinking mind stops, isn't it? It's nonplussed, it can't, it just stops rattling on, and you're stunned or awed by maybe beauty or mystery. Or one could live in this world, just, you know, the beautiful night, and go to the Grand Canyon, see, you know, go to the top of Mount Everest, and be always concerned with yourself. Now, I feel like this, and I don't like that. What am I going to do? How am I going to pay the bill? However, got a bad relationship with this person, don't get along with the boss. And so you know, on a personal level, we can just be carried into this dreary world of me and mine, and all its petty little concerns, worries, obsessions, and not, you know, and be in the most, you know, wonderful places and not even notice. But we can't live in the top of Mount Everest or a place like that, so we have Buddha images or shrines. So we've had, you know, built this, improved the shrine here in the temple recently, which I like very much. Thanks to the efforts of Ajahn Gundasilo and the John Groves. So I asked them to do it. And so they did. They, you know, something that it aesthetically pleases me. I like looking at it. So that helps. I mean, at least it, you know, attractive or beauty draws your attention. But it's not the ultimate, it's not just about having beautiful objects to look at. It's about, it's, one could just be caught up with aesthetics. But it's, and one does, you know, that becomes full of my view and what I think is beautiful and what I don't like. But that's not the point of the shrine. It's to remind us of Bhutto Pachubanatama, anatta, emptiness. Now that's up to you, how you, you know, how you use the situation you're in. But the encouragement is always this awareness reflecting from this position of Bhutto rather than from me and what I think and my feelings. It's very interesting spending so many years doing this, reflecting, meditating this way, because, you know, you do, you know, seeing the personality. I've seen my personality operate. I know how it works. I've become a witness of my personal habits, my tendencies as a personality, as an individual, as a this body, this being here. So it's like the knowing then is not judgmental even, it's just knowing the vipaka kamma of this creature, of this form, having been born, you know, it's 75 years old. So these are perceptions in terms of age of the body, isn't it? But if this would not be 75 years old if it was never born, which is a kind of obvious truism, but it is an important reflection. Birth is, you know, this is the result of birth. Being old is the result of being born. And this is just the way it is. It's not judging it and saying it's good or bad, but it is like this. So this is Bhutto observing Tammo, or the Buddha and the Dhamma. And so, you know, when people say, you know, they get diseases, terminal illnesses, cancer, they lose what they love, their life can be, you know, a continuous experience of stress and pain and misery, and they say, why me? Because it's taken all in a very personal way, because we don't know any better, we have no other perspective. And then from this perspective, Bhutto, knowing Dhamma, then it's the result of birth. Everything goes back. If none of us were born, we wouldn't have any. You know, we wouldn't be old, having old bodies, or we wouldn't be nuns or monks, senior, junior, Thai or English, male or female. It wouldn't have any of these. It's because of birth, isn't it? Physical birth, that we have bodies like this, male bodies, female bodies, identities in terms of nationality, race, identifying with the age of the body, with appearance, you know, what it looks like, with the color of the skin, like this, with perceptions like being Jewish or white Anglo-Saxon Protestant or black. I mean, these are projections onto the conditions. Being Christian, Protestant, Catholic, atheist, Buddhist, Theravadan, Mahayana, Muslim, whatever. These are human-made projections, you know, concepts that we grasp, you know, out of ignorance. Now, not saying these concepts, not judging them, but recognizing they're, you know, they are what they are. Like sexual identities, so say being gay, or bisexual, or heterosexual. These are projections onto the karma we have regarding sexual habits or tendencies. And these can be our identity for our life, how we live our life, always through, you know, identifying with a perception. Like Jewish people always have a strong sense of that identity, you know, being Jewish, which is separate. I don't have such a strong a racial or ethnic identity. It's never been, you know, a kind of strong identity of that's been important to me, to be a white man or something. It's just not, doesn't seem, you know, anything I'm going to fight for or die for or dedicate my life to. But, you know, most Jewish people very determined to hold that identity and make that very dominant one. There's nothing wrong with the identity, but it is a perception in terms of Pachubanatama, isn't it? It's about here and now. Or being gay, this is a strong issue at this time. You know, the sexual identities that bring up a strong sense of identity with sexual tendencies. And these can become, you know, how we live our life, just, you know, with this perception of ourselves, never questioning, never getting beyond it, but merely experiencing life through clinging to this view. And it's not that I'm criticizing the view, but it's noticing the suffering that is created, the separation. If, you know, if you cling to something like whatever, it always, you feel separated from the condition that isn't that way. So if you're Jewish, you're identified with that, then you feel very separate from Gentiles. There's two kinds of human beings, Jews and Gentiles. So, I mean, if this is your soul identity and your kind of obsession, then you're always going to feel threatened by that, not because of being Jewish, but by ignorant clinging to that identity. Or if you see yourself as gay as being your main identity, then you're always going to feel in opposition to those who don't have that identity. So I mean, this is clinging to or being just male or female. If you're obsessed with the gender of being a man or woman, then you always feel opposed to the opposite. It's a separate sense of me and mine, and a defense of it, or a dislike of it. One can hate one's gender, or hate one's sexual tendencies, or hate one's national identity. So the real world, is it these various perceptions? Because we get, when we're born, then we get whatever our parents give us. They tell us these things, or we have vipaka kamma, we have tendencies, genetic or cultural or what, tendencies towards various preferences. And so in this puto tamo, we actually have a way of observing. And it's not in denying or destroying, but in putting them in their proper place. Conditioned phenomena is like this. All conditions are impermanent. All dhamma is not self. So then, either being a gypsy or being English, or then we can be very identified with being from Yorkshire or Lancaster or Southern. I mean, any of these identities are, they are what they are. So this is not passing judgment, it's observing. When I identify myself as American, then I feel that there are those that don't identify with being American. So it's Americans against the rest of the world. Or if you're whatever nationality you're particularly obsessed with being, or maybe you don't know who you are, maybe you don't really have strong sense of being British or European or whatever. Maybe you don't have strong identities of any sort, but you would like them to belong to a group, to have a club or a group or a cause to identify with, to be somebody with a purpose, belong to the right group, the right social group to be, and so, here in England is a surprising to an American how strongly class identities are in this country. Like working class in this country, people with working class, I've seen them where that's how they view life and their relationship to the society is, I'm working class, or middle class, upper class, upper middle class, lower middle class. So that's the cultural, one of the cultural conditions of this society, and it's not nothing wrong with it, but if it's identified with, if it's grasped blindly, then it is a form of alienation from the rest, separateness, separating. Now just contemplate this Pachubanatama is not, it doesn't separate you, it brings you into the totality of the moment. Because it's not, it's before the personality arises or the separateness arises. Me and mine and my life and my body and all that. So this is like to really cherish this moment of just all-encompassing openness, receptivity to the present. And this is, you know, the gift of our human condition. We can actually do this. This is not just theoretical and asking you to do something, you know, that'd be nice if we could, but we can't, nobody can really do it. But it is, it's very simple, very direct. But when you think about it, you're going to get all confused, because thinking itself, the thinking process, its function is to divide and separate, to make judgments, to criticize. And that's what thinking does, isn't it? When you think about yourself or about anything at all, it's you create divisions in your mind, because that's what thinking does. It's for comparing, this is bigger, smaller. This is the best, that's the worst. This is right and that's wrong. This is normal and that's abnormal. So, and that's thinking, which has this dualistic division as a result of attaching to thinking, to perception, to conception, out of ignorance, then we're always in this state of fear or anxiety or separation. There's always an enemy, an alien, a dark force, something that opposes me in some way, or could, or seems. There's ghosts in the forest. There can be all kinds of imagined enemies and dark forces and demons in a dark night in the woods. You can create all kinds of benevolent forces in the sky, you know, the angels, the devadas, the ethereal heavenly creatures that love me and protect me. But when there's ethereal creatures that love and protect me, there's also devils and demons that want to hurt me and harm me. So this structure is the division that's caused through attachment to Sakkaya Ditti, Silabhata Paramasa Vicikicca. You're always creating, you know, whatever you attach to, it has its opposite. So, being aware of this, not to destroy the conditioned realm, but to no longer be deluded by it. So like your own personality, whatever it may be, you know, because it changes, and whether you're feeling happy or sad depends on other conditions. You can't feel happy if you're sick and nobody loves you, and you find out you have fatal disease, and you're alone and out in the cold, the conditions for happiness are not there. And so then we become miserable and lost because the conditions for that particular feeling are present. Feeling lost, alone, out in the cold, diseased, sick, unwanted, rejected, Then there's the awareness of that, you know, awareness that if you're happy or miserable, now this is this awareness is not happy or miserable. It doesn't take on the condition and you know, unless you're ignorant. If you're if there's avijja, then your conscious experience of life is always permeated with this sense of good, bad, right, and wrong. But if you begin to recognize this purity of conscious awareness in the present, you know, then the misery or the joy is, you know, it's recognized. It is the way it is. But our refuge is not in the condition anymore, but in this knowing, in this awareness. So that's the liberation from birth and death. You know, the whole point of our life now as samanas is liberation from ignorance, from birth and death. Amaravati, deathless realm. That's the goal. That's our aim to not just to you know, believe in something called deathless, but to be that, to keep reminding that this death-bound condition that we call my body is, you know, it's going to die. You know, this is, it's not going to live forever. And then the result of having lived this many years is, you know, the conditions of an old body. And then the results of living as a Buddhist monk for so many years is like this. And because of the, you know, the emphasis of this tradition, then, you know, over the years, I've been able to, you know, really sort things out to see, get this perspective, and cultivate this awareness, put it to a test, experiment with it, investigate. It's not just a, you know, it's not based on believing in Buddhism at all. So the result of this is completion of my 43rd vasa as a bhikkhu. Then I had 1 year as a samanera. So, you know, that's 44 years of, you know, of this lifespan of this body that's been dedicated towards liberation. You know, moving, always remembering, cultivating through the trials and tribulations, vipaka, kamma, successes, failures, praise and blame that I experience in, you know, in whatever ways. Because becoming a monk or nun doesn't mean you get out of everything, or you know, you're kind of in a realm where, you know, everybody's just so sweet and nice and fair and good and understanding. But as you all know, living in communities is like this, you know, where you have so many different people to live with different karmic tendencies, different attitudes, different expectations. How many of you really come into this life for liberation? complete liberation from birth and death, or come into this life to get some peace, or belong to a nice group of people, or what are you expecting from becoming, ordaining as a samana? You know, what do you expect from it on a personal level? What do you hope to get out of it? So, you know, that we can have different expectations and hopes. And we come into this life with that. You know, we come in with this idea, I'm ignorant, unenlightened person that needs to do something, hoping that this kind of life will, you know, help me in some way. You have some kind of interest, faith enough to make some commitment to it. You know, to try it out at least, see what happens. But if this life increases sakya ditti silabhata paramasa vicikicca, don't blame the tradition. It's you know, how more direct can I be, you know, in pointing at what we're, you know, the aim of this life is liberation. And if you're not liberated, then what are you attached to? What still binds you to samsara? To the sense of yourself, your identities? Because that's certainly not the goal of our life, or not what I try to encourage. I don't want to create any more, I don't want to reinforce sakya ditti in any of you. I don't want to, because I'm in a position of authority, you know, where you have to listen to me in the past week. And, you know, in a senior position, so I have authority. Now, using that authority for pointing, you know, not at myself or at what I think or believe in as a person, but always pointing at Pachubanatama, liberation here and now, and then giving this sense of, you know, go for it, do it. Don't just wonder about whether you can or not, or whether maybe I'm just, you know, deluded monk. You know, you don't know. Maybe I've got it all wrong. But the point is not to spend your time figuring out whether I'm right or wrong, but what I'm trying to do is encourage you to put it to the test, to really, you know, cultivate, investigate this present, here and now, this body, these emotions, these memories, thoughts, habits, happiness, misery, whatever you're feeling in this moment. And then to really question that which is aware. If I'm feeling unhappy and unloved at this moment, that which is aware of that, you know, so you know, right now I just feel so depressed and so disappointed because of... But you know that that's a feeling you have in the present moment. What is it that knows that? So this is like inquiring into the present. There's feeling anger in the present. Somebody said something that made me feel angry. I feel angry because you called me snot-nosed. There's a knowing of anger, isn't there? What is it that knows that? And so, like questioning that ability to observe that you feel this feeling in the present is like this. Now that awareness, That's consciousness. You don't go unconscious. There's consciousness combined with mindfulness and then panya, wisdom, discernment. So you discern this awareness. It's not sad or happy or angry or greedy. But it certainly recognizes that on an emotional level I might feel sad, angry, greedy, frightened, whatever it's like. And so just beginning to discern, know that this awareness and its object, the emotional state you're aware of. Now, as a person, you can't be aware of being aware. You know, so, you know, in trying to, you know, trying to play games with your mind by saying, I'm trying to be aware of being aware. It's not, you can't be aware of being aware. You can recognize awareness when there is and when there isn't. Now, when I get caught up in a mood or emotion, then I become an angry person. And if there, you know, if there's not awareness of this, then it's like just a reaction. You say, Ajahn Sumedho's snot-nosed bully, and then I feel angry, and then how dare you talk to me like you should be respectful. And then I become angry. And then that's a rebirth, isn't it? That's rebirth. When I become, you know, somebody insults me, and then I become angry, and I become an angry man, and then I say things or do things from that, that's rebirth. That's another birth. Becoming, isn't it? That's what rebirth is about, becoming something, becoming a condition. Or knowing a condition is not becoming that condition. So like mindfulness is our ability to observe. And this is what struck me when I went to stay with Lungpo Cha. They use this Bhutto mantra all the time. And then they translate it into Thai Puru, which is one who knows, the knowing. Well, before that, before I met Lungpo Cha, I'd always seen Buddha as a kind, in a very kind of an academic way. You know, something, you know, like a prophet or, you know, the founder of Buddhism, or it was more historical or academic use of the word Buddha. And then because of this emphasis on Bhutto in Wat Pa Phong, then as I learned Thai language, you know, to find, say, Purul, to know, the knowing, that which knows. And suddenly I got the point, you know, it's kind of the penny dropped, you know, something, you know, that really helps me to know, to have this. It's not just kind of being Buddhist and respecting Buddha and having definitions of Buddha, but it's actually much more direct than all that. You know, it's not merely academic or conceptual, but it's immediate. This ability to be a witness to the present. So then, of course, the ego says, well, who is it that knows then? Who's the puru? Who's the knowing? What is it that knows? And then of course, you say, well, it's Buddha that knows. So there must be a kind of, I'll call it Buddha. So then, there's a Buddha inside me that knows. Then it gets into silliness, doesn't it? It's just kind of, you know, reinforcing the sense that I'm somebody with a little Buddha inside me that knows. So it's not being silly or claiming it, but it's to say, do it, you know. Be the knowing, be this awakened knowing now, Pachubana Dhamma, the way it is, which includes, you know, maybe whatever you're feeling. It includes everything of this present moment, everything that you're feeling, experiencing, you know, physically, mentally, emotionally, belongs in this moment. Everything, you know, there's not a matter of, even if it's anger or some nasty thought or whatever, it belongs. The demon, the angel, it all belongs, if it's present here and now. But then your relationship to it changes from me and mine to knowing all conditions are impermanent, because you're no longer trying to control and divide the situation by getting rid of the demons and holding on to the angels, but you're actually allowing, there's room for all of that in this present moment, because you are this totality rather than this person that's got to sort everything out and get rid of the bad and hold on to the good. So then we have the structures, the conventional structures of monasticism, which are about doing good and refraining from doing bad. You know, so like Vinaya. Vinaya is all about proper behavior and things like that, to do good, refrain from doing bad. It doesn't mean that we, if everything's the same, all conditions are just impermanent, then we can, you know, do any of them. It's not what they call antinomianism, do whatever you feel like in the moment, but when you commit yourself to this form, then you're committing yourself to the sila, or to do good intention, to use the bodies we have and the ability to speak, not no longer as divisive personal habits, but being responsible for, you know, not deliberately harming or insulting or deluding, misusing, exploiting. So this is this because the moral precepts, morality, do good, refrain from doing bad. It's interesting, and at a time like this, which is so idealistic about rights, you know, free speech, you know, the listening to some of the discussions on Radio 4 about views about freedom of speech, you know, so it's, you know, do Nazis have the right to come in? Talk about, you know, anti-Semitism, because they're free. You know, is it, you know, it's free speech. People should be able to say anything. This is a land where we're free to say what we think. And so this free speech is an ideal, isn't it? Freedom of speech means that we are, you know, we have this sense we can say what we think, or we, you know, we're not going to be punished or persecuted by saying, you know, not by saying the critical things about the government or about others. We're in a kind of tyrannical society, you know, you've got these different secret service organizations on your neck the minute you say something against the government. But here we can say, oh, the Labour Party's rubbish. You hear that all the time now. The Labour Party really is in the pits of people's critical minds. And you're not going to be arrested for it or, you know, for criticizing. But then how much, you know, then there's right speech, you know, like samawaja in our sense. What's the difference between free speech and right speech? So in this way, you know, right speech is being able to discern what is appropriate. What is just me being angry and prejudiced and just spouting off my angry views and biases about the government or the people or whatever. That's not right speech, is it? And yet I can still have the assumption from the free speech ideal that I have a right to say whatever. And so like in reflection, like being able to observe, if I use bad speech, speak in anger, if I speak in anger, if I cause division, I'm deliberately putting down, insulting, demeaning, lying, or whatever. And I put this into speech, then what is the result of that? You know, from the puto position, then I can see that it makes me feel, you know, if I tell a lie, nobody may know, but I do. And that's hiriotapa. You know, I could tell you all lies, and you might not know that I'm lying, but I know. What is that? There's a knowing, isn't it? There's a knowing when I'm speaking from anger. If I'm just spouting off because I'm angry with you, and I'm just chastising you and blaming you for all my misery in the world and the problems of modern life, or finding some scapegoat, some group to point to and say, hate them, they're the evil forces. You know, if there's awareness, that is not a very, that's an ugly state of mind to grasp. You know, being angry is a really, you know, a very powerful emotion. And if you don't know it, then you just live in that, you know, people get angry very easily and then they get overwhelmed with their anger. And then we can say things in anger, or act on anger and do very harmful things to ourselves or others. But in samawaja, then right speech, it's not about political correctness, trying to be so polite that nobody's ever offended, because then it goes into being precious and where you're afraid to say anything very directly because whatever you say is going to offend somebody, or it might. So we can go the other extreme, not wanting to say anything because it might upset somebody. But so samawaja, from the insight level then, this is the Eightfold Path, or perfect speech, to say, from the Four Noble Truths level, where the insights into these noble truths leads to the four, you know, the first three. Then the fourth is samadhiti, perfect understanding of truth. So then it's then the samavajja comes from wisdom, from like how we use speech. Then is coming from wisdom rather than from prejudice, moods, anger, taking sides, trying to be polite and nice about everything, trying to ignore, just using speech to feel good. Or you use speech to harm and insult, to use our speech to, you know, or just to, you know, believe in our own, what we're thinking. How many of you really believe in every thought that you have? I don't believe in any of them, my thoughts. Because, you know, it's still the vipaka kamma of this being here arises. So it has its certain tendencies, certain inclinations, certain preferences, things like this. Not that I don't, as a person, have any more preferences. But it's knowing those, not grasping those, not operating from personal personality habits. So it's awakening to the... So then the personality is, you know, some we all have different personalities. So like in Thailand, for example, you've got, say, Lungpo Cha, as one, you know, who is a very ebullient, metta, kind of loving-kindness, charming, welcoming personality as a person. He was very charming person. Then there's Ajahn Mahabua, who's very fierce and gruff. So Lungpo Cha would welcome and Ajahn Mahabhu would probably grunt or tell you to get out or do something. And then so you think, you know, both are supposed to be enlightened masters, but yet they manifest differently, you know, as persons, personalities. Lungpo Liam, you know, the head monk now in Thailand of our group in Wat Pa Phong. You know, you have to go and kind of say, look at me, you know. He's very reserved and kind of, he doesn't go and reach out, or at least I hear he's more so now. I mean, he used to, you know, never look at you and just was very quiet. And yet he's a very wise monk. So it's just different how different people manifest. And it's not, say, that one is better than the other. We might prefer, you know, one to the other, or... But that's not the point, is it? It's not to... You've developed an arahant personality. A kind of Buddha-rupa inscrutability. So that, you know, you just like the Buddha Rupa, you could curse at it or praise it or thing, and it is inscrutable. It doesn't show any emotion. Always calm, composed. That's a Buddha Rupa made out of bronze. But notice that human beings are like this. We have faces, you know, habits, tendencies, manifest what we're feeling, and that can appear on our physiognomy, body language, because we're, you know, we're vibrations, we're moving, changing conditions of bodies we have, and the emotional habits, the vipaka kamma, is not made out of bronze and marble. It's like this, it's all very sensitive. all these nerve endings in the human body. You've ever seen charts of nerve endings in the human body? It's just amazing. You know, no wonder life is this way, because we're just a form so sensitive, so bundle of nerves, you know, about everything. It's a wonder that we can ever transcend it. Just seems like we're just helpless victims of sensitivity and unrelenting impingement on these senses and these bodies from birth to death. Where the Buddha Rupa doesn't have any nerves whatsoever. So the Buddha Rupa is an ideal, you know. But we, you know, we're not made out of bronze. We have to live with these conditions, with nerves, with blood, with digestion. We have to digest food every day. We have to defecate and urinate. These bodies you have to keep them warm when it's cold and cool when it's hot. We always have to deal with the various functions, the organs going off or getting diseased or colds or flu or whatever. You know, the things that are blowing around in the air and that come into these forms. So we could blow all the flu germs towards the Buddha Rupa and it would not suffer one single bit. Where on a retreat, you know, like the last retreat I gave, sitting on this platform in the retreat center, and all the flu germs came right toward me. Maybe they were paying respect, I don't know. That's one way of looking at it. But I wish they go away rather than toward me. That's personal. But you have to deal with germs and things you can't even see, that, you know, microscopic things that are floating in the air that you can't even imagine can affect this form, where it doesn't bother the Buddha Rupa one single bit. So this might be overstating something, but it's trying to make a point of you know, how do we live with these forms, these very sensitive forms, in which we're not just helpless victims of what's happening to them. Because we don't have that much control over, you know, to control the environment and the community and everything around, so that we're, you know, we can't live in a totally sterile environment. We've got to live, you know, in this place with these conditions. And then our relationship is no longer one of identity or fear or you know, being caught up in the conditioned realm as a just helpless kind of victim of circumstances, but this ability to observe mindfulness, putto, pachubana dhamma. So the body, the feelings, the state of mind, the Dhamma, the four foundations of mindfulness, four noble truths, eightfold path, dependent origination, the 10 fetters, the four stages, all these are the kind of skillful means the Buddha left us to sort it out, to sort this thing out, this strange experience we're all having, being incarcerated in this absurd form for a lifetime in a society that's very, very ignorant, in a world where there's, you know, it's never been so many people living on this planet, human beings at one time, you know. And all the rest of the environmental problems and so forth, social, international, endless conflicts and wars and jealousies and competitions and people demanding. Every small ethnic group now wants their own rights. You know, so you've got the Basque movement, the Catalan movement, Wales and Scotland separate from England. Pretty soon it'll be Yorkshire and Lancashire, and then Hertfordshire. And then European Union, you know, then so we all unite as one European entity, but then it even increases the conflicts. Because all these different ethnic groups, you know, want the rights. And so it goes on and on, you know, things change, you know, in Yugoslavia, there used to be a country called Yugoslavia. And that's gone now. You know, I never heard of the idea of Bosnia, it never occurred to me. Bosnia-Herzegovina. I had heard of Croatia and Serbia. But I didn't really, you know, it was all called Yugoslavia, including Macedonia, Kosovo, Montenegro. It's all in Serbia and Slovenia, Croatia. It's all Yugoslavia. Only a few years ago. Now it's all broken up into different Albanian minorities and on like that, fighting and yelling and blaming and becoming righteous and resentful of things done in the past, goes on and on and on. Into, this is all, what, human ignorance, thinking, and division. Identifying with a particularly a language or a ethnic identity. Most of us wouldn't know the difference between a Croatian and a Serbian and a Bosnian. They all look the same to me. Just like the Welsh and the Scots and the English. To an American, they're all the same. But then, of course, what you identify with is gives you this separate identity. And just notice that whatever you identify with and grasp out of ignorance creates its opposite. There's always fear and resentment, something opposed, an alien force, an enemy, just because of this delusion of ignorance and because we're so limited by our thinking capacity, we're forced into taking sides all the time, into division. So the aim of, say, you know, not to make all the conditions equal. You've got to respect the differences, but know them as conditions from this bhutto, knowing Dhamma, rather than from me and wanting all the conditions to be equal. I would like to go back to Yugoslavia and have, you know, all the Croatians, Serbians, Kosovo, whatever they are, and Macedonians and Bosnians, you know, all get along and be nice to each other and cooperate, help each other, love each other, support each other. That would be really nice. But why can't we do that? Because of ignorance. And is that what we have to do? You know, always be nice and try to live on a high level of conditioned aspiration, or be liberated from ignorance. And so this is getting to the root of the matter. You know, the problem is avijja and ignorance of Dhamma, not knowing we're bound into this whirlpool of conditioned phenomena, samsara, with no way out. But because there is the unborn, uncreated, unformed, unconditioned, there is escape from the born, the created, the formed, the conditioned. And this is the escape, awareness, mindfulness, wisdom. So now this is the end of the community retreat. Tomorrow is the Pavarana day. And so these are, you know, then that we go back to what we call normal life or whatever. It, you know, our determination to stay here for the 3 months has been completed. This is tradition. You know, part of an agreed way of talking and behaving. So, I mean, this is tradition, it's convention. Now, how we use this convention for division and for our own personal feelings or for with awareness. Now, so the relationships of the bhikkhu, Siladhara Sangha, that based on competition, on envy, on identity, or on respect, gratitude. You say, well, we should mutually admonish each other is one view. But then in this tradition, you know, it's about the bhikkhus give pavarana amongst each other. And then the Siladharas give pavarana amongst themselves. This is the invitation for admonishment and advice and help. And then the Siladhara Sangha gives pavarana to the Bhikkhu Sangha. So this is because it's the Bhikkhu Sangha that ordains you, that gives you the bapacha. And the Samaneras, Anagarikas, give pavaran. Because it's the Bhikkhu Sangha that is the one that gives the ordination. You can't become a Siladhara except through the Bhikkhu Sangha. So it's a way of showing this respect and gratitude, rather than seeing it as a kind of demeaning, kind of resignation to male power. See it as something beautiful, as a way of saying thank you, and as a group, rather than, it's not individual. So we're not, you know, if the bhikkhus are using it as a way of, you know, having power over the nuns, that's not the purpose, that's a misuse of it. We're not here to, you know, to use male aggression against women, but it's a relationship based on respect, appreciation, which is ennobling us, rather than and then it gives a sense of the Bhikkhu Sangha not as individual. Ajahn Sumedho or Ajahn Vajira and that kind of thing, as monks, you know, and as individuals, but as a sangha that has carried the tradition forward from the time of the Buddha to this present time. It's a way of acknowledging that in this tradition and appreciating it. So it's a way of how you want to look at it. You know, you're free to look at it any way you want. But, you know, this is to me, this is a skillful way of looking at it, because it ennobles us, it opens our heart, it brings beautiful qualities of gratitude and appreciation. So we have these, you know, the Lungpa Sha Rupa, that shrine, and then Ajahn Achalo arranged to have these photos of Lungpu Man and Lungpu Cha on the main shrine, because they're the kind of what we all, you know, relate to in lineage. None of us knew Ajahn Man. I didn't know Ajahn Man, but he died long before I arrived in Thailand. But Ajahn Chah, I knew very well. But Ajahn Man is kind of the kind of acknowledged patriarch of the Thai forest tradition. A very wise and very highly regarded monk. And he's not from ancient time. He died, I think, in 1950s sometime. But this is a lineage, you know. We have the 28 Buddhas chant. This lineage is a tradition. Oh, you don't, you know, you can dismiss it or ignore it, but also it can be used, a sense of continuity from the time of the Buddha. I've always seen this particular lineage through Ajahn Man, through the Thai forest tradition, as a kind of, it's been a kind of, when I first arrived in Thailand, it was the roads, infrastructure of Thailand was not very developed. So the Thai forest tradition was just beginning to be recognized in Bangkok. You know, just, they lived usually in northeast Thailand or in northern Thailand, like hermits or something. They were kind of outside the main thing, of where Bangkok was the center of everything. And then suddenly the king and became aware and, you know, admired the forest monks. Ajahn Man was very influential in bringing into the consciousness of Thais this tradition, which is based on Batibata practice, where so much of Thai Buddhism is based on Bariyati, you know, on study and learning Pali and studying about Buddhism. And this is Lungpu Man, Lungpu Cha were very much on Batibata practice, putting it into practice, making it work inside. And so this is like, to me, the real function, a kind of purity of this, from the time of the Buddha. This is what, to me, the Lord Buddha did, you know, in 2,552 years ago. Set forth a way of practice, not just a kind of academic philosophy, but it wasn't just an intellectual game of high-minded thinking, but it's actually very practical, and putting it into practice. So this tradition has this kind of purity of lineage from traced through these forest monks. And these forest monks lived in throughout Southeast Asia, in Cambodia or Laos or Thailand, usually outside the main centers. We're oftentimes considered just kind of hermits or ignorant monks that, you know, that were not recognized by the majority. Now this Thai forest tradition has come into consciousness internationally, worldwide, through efforts of Ajahn Man and Ajahn Chah, and through mass media and the modernization of Thailand and everything else, so that this tradition is no longer just remote Southeast Asian, up in the mountains, out in the borderlands of Thailand anymore, but it's here in Hertfordshire. So it's not to be kind of worshipped as a kind of sacred tradition, just to kind of hold it up and say, isn't it wonderful, but to actually use it, make it work, put it into practice. So you're all a part of this tradition. You're in this lineage, the power of this ancient lineage. And like the Siladhars, even though you may feel that you're kind of a new form, don't make that into an obstruction. Because the Bhikkhu Sangha is giving you this lineage. You know, this is what Bapa Cha is about. The Bhikkhu Sangha here puts you into this lineage from from Ajahn Mun, and probably from the Buddha of ancient India. So this is something to really respect and a sense of appreciation for opportunity to see, this is, and how to use this lineage, this practice. Like, it's giving you this sense of use it, make it work. Don't endlessly quibble about, the things you don't like about it or the way that you might prefer it to be, but use it for awareness to extirpate avijja. Be free from ignorance. So today is we're releasing you from noble silence, which you've kept assiduously, I know, during and then tomorrow's a Pavarana day. And then the rest is the unknown, isn't it? Who goes where, what happens, and all that. But whatever happens, wherever you're going, keep this in mind, keep determining to remind yourself, Pachubanatama, Puto, here and now. Trust it. No matter how many emotions about doubt and confusion you might have, don't trust that. Don't believe in your feelings. It's not to get rid of them, but to know they are dependent on other conditions. And that which is aware is your refuge. Awareness, not the feeling.